And we'll proceed when everyone's ready with the second case of the morning. The trustees of the Chicago Painters versus Salma Darwin et al. Berglund.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Joseph Berglund. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Royal International Drywall and Decorating. Your Honors, the trial court clearly erred in entering judgment for what is referred to as accumulated liquidated damages. This is a separate cause of action, separate and apart from the audit that is at issue in this case. The accumulated liquidated damages refers to contributions that were paid by Royal prior to the filing of the lawsuit, but were paid untimely. This is a claim which was never alleged in the fund's complaint.
Is all this set out in Exhibit 15? I frankly haven't looked at it. It's somewhere in the record. You didn't present it with your filing, I don't believe.
I did not present what?
Exhibit 15, I believe it's called. Isn't that where there's some reference to that?
There's a claim that says it's referenced in the audit.
Okay, yes. But I haven't seen it. I don't know. Does that say anything that, in addition, is that going to point out what the liquidated damages are, the calculation?
No.
All right, go ahead.
No. The trial court noted in her June 29th, 2004 opinion on pages 28 to 29 at footnote 51 that the funds provide no support for their contention that defendant owes this amount. What happened is that the trial court ordered the parties to simultaneously file proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law after the trial, and in their proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, the fund sought to recover accumulated liquidated damages for which they never alleged was owed in their complaint and for which they never presented any evidence to the trial court.
Okay, so bottom line, what you're saying is that the funds never sought relief based on late contributions and only sought to impose that particular form of liability until post-trial. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. That is exactly what happened here, Judge. After the trial court issued her June 29th...
Just jog my memory. Forgive me. What portions would the liquidated damages for late contributions amount to?
That is $17,955.82.
Say it again, please.
$17,955.82.
Thank you.
Thank you. And going to the other issue in this case, what I'll refer to as a material audit. A material audit is different than the fund's regular audit. The funds typically perform a payroll audit. They'll look at the payroll records and determine if they match the contributions paid by the employer to the funds. A material audit is based upon the amount of drywall material purchased by Royal International. The audit results don't show or state Royal owes, ten hours for employee A for January 2006.
But Mr. Berglund, forgive me, but you suggested in your briefs is that rather than conducting a material audit, the fund should simply have spoken to Royal's employees to see whether they were being paid by the hours reported, right?
Yes.
Okay. Is that really reasonable for the funds to expect that Royal's employees would be forthcoming when, you know, their jobs might be at stake here?
Well, their jobs aren't at stake. If the funds are claiming that Royal owes contributions, if they have evidence that employee A didn't receive 10 hours of benefits for each week of his employment, then that would be a proper computation of damages. Then that employee would then get the credit for the contributions for its Royal paid benefits. Now, in this case, the trial court found that Royal International International's employees could not have finished tape more than 2.86 sheets of drywall per hour. Now, that's contrary to the evidence that was submitted to the judge and evidence that the trial court refused to consider. The trial court relied upon testimony of Ian Parr. He was not asked to prepare a productivity rate for Royal's employees. He was asked to prepare an industry standard rate, which covers a lot of projects, not just Royal's operations.
Royal's operations, it was based on piecework, is that correct?
Well, Royal was engaged in the business of essentially taping residential homes, tract housings.
But I mean, I understand what piecework is. It's based on the individual's productivity, and I don't know how they calculated it, but was that generally how the employees were paid?
No.
Was it hourly?
There was testimony from some employees that they were paid hourly, and there were two employees, former employees, Luis Sanchez and Jose Marino, who testified they were not paid hourly.
How were they paid?
They were paid per sheet of drywall that they had taped.
And I call that piecework.
Yes.
I guess what the court was doing was saying that the records presented didn't give him a method to weigh it, or her, I don't remember who the judge was, but didn't give a method of calculating the time spent, and the CBA said something about it's based on hourly, on each hour worked. Now that's, I guess, where they were trying to translate whatever records they had into some formula, which you say was underestimated the ability of the workers.
Yes, the problem with the formula is that it didn't allow for productivity that exceeded that rate. The formula, it wasn't tested. The Ian Parr never observed Royal's employees at work.
Yeah. Well, I know this isn't an issue, but I guess, isn't there an wage and hour issue here? Is somebody not getting paid for overtime and other things? Did that ever come up in some other forum?
There could be an issue. It never arose in this case. Mm-hmm. But you are right. It could be an issue.
But it just happens that they're looking at it for a different reason, but for the same basis. They're trying to find out how many hours were actually worked, and therefore how much money is owed.
Yes.
And that's the calculation that we looked at. It's obviously a pretty tedious analysis.
Very tedious. But I believe there's too many variables involved to make a determination based upon their formula. There are other ways to do it properly. One way would be is if former employee Luis Sanchez testified he wasn't paid 10 hours per week for each week he worked, then the funds can compute how much is owed for him in terms of fringe benefits. There are other employees that testified they were paid on an hourly basis.
You're saying this has to be done. Each employee's got to line up, say, how they were paid in order to determine how much is owed.
I believe, yes, that's the case, Judge. Because there are some employees who testified they were paid properly.
How many employees are we talking about?
Approximately 47. And of the 47, two of them testified that they were paid piecework.
You know, Mr. Berglund, at times in the brief, this is the briefs, you appear to be suggesting that as long as an employee's records appear facially adequate, that's the end of any inquiry. And my question would be, even if records on their face appear to be adequate, why aren't the funds entitled to look behind those records by doing a material audit in order to see whether, Royal or any other company might be under reporting hours?
I don't believe a material audit is the proper method to determine if an employer is properly reporting hours. There's just too many variables involved. There was testimony from John Hall and a taper could not finish tape more than 22 sheets per hour. We submitted videotaped evidence which showed a taper can finish tape 4.25 sheets an hour. I don't think that that is an appropriate method to determine if an employer is properly paying or reporting hours.
Would you agree that this is the kind of case that depends on the inferences and credibility assessments? Would you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't, Your Honor. I think there's too many variables involved in the formula that they derived.
So it comes down to looking at each employee. Each employee basically, I guess, testifying how he or she was paid. And I don't know. We're estimating how long it took them, and then everybody has a different rate of speed for doing this, and then you calculate that to hours based on. I just don't know how. I'm not sure there is a way to assess this perfectly. Therefore, we're stuck with what the district court did, unless there's some simpler way to look at it from here.
The reason why I suggest that the employee should come forward and testify is the funds claim that Royal owes contributions for its employees. There were two employees that claimed they worked more hours than were reported by Royal. Then that's the funds claim. It should be only for those two employees, not for all 47 employees.
How many employees were individually, I don't know, deposed, testified, or otherwise assessed individually? How many?
There were two former employees that testified they were not properly paid, and there were three or four employees who testified they were properly paid.
So we have a total of seven or six or something out of 47?
Yes.
And you say the only way to do this is go through all 47?
If the funds are claiming the contributions are owed, they have the burden to prove who is owed the contributions. I don't think they can just extrapolate this information.
Are there any present employees who testified that they were paid piecework?
No.
Isn't there a method of punching people in and out on time? I've, in my checkered past, I've worked in hourly rates. Now I work on yearly rates. But we always had a place where we punched in and punched out, or somebody was keeping record of when we came in and when we quit.
Not in the construction industry, Judge.
I oddly enough, did work in the construction industry on occasion. And they kept track of the hours we worked. That's how I got paid.
In this case, a lot of the employees would report directly to the to the job site. A lot of them
reported directly to the job site on many occasions, but they kept track of when I reported and when I left. And you don't do that.
Oh, no. The hours were kept track of, and in most cases, the employees filled out the timesheets.
So it was a matter of the employee deciding to tell, and the employer accepted whatever the employee wrote down.
Yes, and the copies of the timesheets were attached to the employee's paychecks.
But the employee was the one who filled out the timesheet.
In most cases, there were two former employees who testified.
The two former employees.
Yes, yes.
Let's say the usual method of doing business was the employee kept track of his time, turned it in, the employer accepted it, and paid him on that predicate.
Yes. It's a self-reporting system.
So it is sort of an honor system, as I think I read.
Well, so if they're shortchanged, they shortchange themselves.
You are correct. That is right.
Well, that's an interesting observation. Right.
They're trying to say, some would say, for fear of losing their job, they had to make the whatever the time spent or what amount charged equal to the amount estimated. Isn't that a claim filtered throughout this, that they may have to work 50 or 60 hours in order to get the job done, which was estimated at a lower amount, and that they were talking about the amount of hours estimated equaled the amount of hours worked, or vice versa?
If a job required more hours, a superintendent would go out to the job site and discuss it with the employee.
They did that.
Yes. We're into your rebuttal time now. I just thought I'd tell you that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. McDowell?
Let me leap right in, sir. Do you accept the position as taken by your opponent that the employees produce their own hourly statements or work statements, so it's a predicate for their payments?
That issue is...
Well, that's not capable of a yes or no answer. Do you,
I would say the answer would be no, based upon what I saw in the district court's description of the record. There appeared to be some discrepancy in that record.
Well, you checked the records yourself before you filed a suit, didn't you?
That's correct, yes.
And were the records kept by the employees?
The
hourly times kept by the employees?
There is an indication, basically.
No. Were the records that you observed, those that the employees themselves signed on for, did they say that these are the hours I worked?
The employees signed...
No. You're not doing it again.
Okay.
Were the records that you looked at those prepared by the employees showing what hours they worked?
They were initially prepared by
employee. I object when my brethren do this, but this time I want.
Okay.
The question, it seems to me, is terribly simple.
Yeah.
If I've stated it improperly, tell me that.
All right.
Were the records that you looked at of hourly times put in by the employees prepared by the employees, yes or no? If it is incapable of a yes or no answer, say you don't know or you don't remember or anything else, but the question as I propounded it is capable of a yes, they were prepared by the employees, or no, they were not.
The answer would be yes in part, unfortunately, because they were initially prepared by the employees. There was evidence in the record that then they were reviewed and sometimes altered.
Your position is that they were tampered with by employers. The employers changed the numbers that the employees put down.
There were some instances of that, and in general, the employees did prepare the records, but... In each case there was, and this came through particularly in the testimony of the witnesses who we called, Mr. Sanchez and Mr. Marino, they frequently were required, basically use the budget as a guide to entering how many hours they worked, and so the hours they worked were not necessarily the hours they actually
worked.
So
they, when they put the figures down, they knew they were false.
That appears to be true in the record. That's correct.
Well, what do you mean it appears to be true?
Did they say that
they were the hours did not that they wrote down did not reflect the hours they worked?
That's correct. That's what Mr. Sanchez stated. He said, for example, he routinely would work 50 or 60 hours, whereas his time records would only indicate, for example, he was working 32 hours.
And the employer gets stuck with the program that he has produced himself. Is that the story?
Well, not exactly, because the story basically is, and this was what the district court did when it looked at the timesheets, it found that there was an incredible intersection between the budgeted amounts that the employer prepared and the amounts that showed up on the timesheet. That's correct.
That is to say the employees were assisting the employers in meeting their bidding process.
I would say that's correct. It was consistent with our contention that what was involved here was basically a piecework system rather than what the contract required, which was that contributions reflect actual hours worked. And that's what the district court basically determined.
I'm trying to find it. You wait until after it's all over and any employees come in and say, we really lied about it. We worked a lot more than that. We're entitled to more compensation.
Well, the answer to that question is the funds have a requirement to enforce the contract, which calls for contributions to be made based upon hours worked, and those contributions will inure to the benefit of the particular employees, but they also obviously inure to the benefit of the fund in general, and we're required to do that.
In addition to my checkered past as an employee part-time, piecework and hourly. I also represented the sheet metal workers, the common laborers, and hod carriers at one time in my career.
Mm-hmm.
And I know precisely how it's done, but the subcontractors were required, or the contractors were required to accept the figures put in by the employee as the hours they put in. And that is not true in this business?
Well, in this particular case where the contract calls for contributions for actual hours worked, it's required under ERISA Section 1059 that there be a record, a method by which you can determine what contributions are required to be paid.
Well, the method that was determined by this group, as I understand it, was that the employee himself did it, or herself.
The employee himself or herself in this case did actually, you know, begin the input of the process.
When they got paid, they got the record of what they put in, a copy of that record.
They got a copy of that record, that's correct.
And they had an opportunity then to say the record is inappropriate, it's not right.
They could arguably do that, and that's, you know, that is something that the employee would have the option to do. However, we have to look at this, I think, in reality of the system here, in which we have a workforce which there were indications, for example, in the testimony of Mr. Sanchez that he was afraid in some situations to come forward because of fears of retaliation.
Did he go to the union and
complain
about that?
In that particular case, I don't believe that he did.
Did anybody come in and beef to the union about it?
What occurred here, I don't know the answer to that. I can't tell you.
You can say that.
Right. I can't tell you the answer on that one.
Did the funds make any effort to speak to people still employed by Royal as opposed to the former employees?
I can't say for certain what was done with respect to looking at, you know, former or current employees. I would assume and I would think that there was an attempt to contact employees in general because we as the fund knew that it was important for us to be able to demonstrate that employees actually had an experience that they were working hours that were not in line with what was indicated in this particular matter. But I can't say for certain who was contacted. And again, when you look at the realities of a drywall workforce, it's frankly a transient workforce. It may be difficult to get this one or that one to come forward. And so I can't state with certainty what the fund did in this matter. It's not specifically in the record.
Before I forget, and I think it's pretty important, regarding the liquidated damages, Royal suggests, of course, that the problem with the liquidated damages for late fees is that this is a distinct form of liability and relief that the funds did not even pursue until after the close of evidence. And I you know, that's in the reply brief. And
I think that in our brief, what we indicated was that what occurred here was, and if you look at the complaint, we did ask for all appropriate relief under ERISA. So there is at least, you know, carried forward in the notice pleading parts of the complaint a request for that. Then we specifically, I believe, introduced Exhibit 15, which I understand to be a report concerning liquidated damages. And further, as our brief indicates, there was an acknowledgement by Mr. Darwin, who's the president of Royal International, that $23,000 in liquidated damages was sought in this matter, was included in the audit. So there were post-trial briefs which then specifically included calculations regarding the amounts of liquidated damages and how they are arrived at. But as I understand, the underlying material regarding liquidated damages could be found in Plaintiff's Exhibit 15.
So it would be utterly incorrect to think for even a moment that the liquidated damages for late contributions would be a problem here.
I don't believe it's a problem because when you look at the liquidated damages, it encompasses at least part of the same audit period as the material audit. And so the issue in this case was whether Royal owed particular amounts of contributions and liquidated damages and interest under ERISA to the funds, and liquidated damages would appear encompassed within that.
Now, one of Royal's points about the productivity rate is that the funds in the district court were looking at an industry-wide standard rather than a standard that reflected the particular context in which Royal's employees worked. Can we be confident that the productivity rate that the district court adopted is accurate in the context of this industry, residential tract housing. Yeah.
The district court, in its opinion, had a fairly extensive discussion of this argument with respect to contrasting residential and commercial drywall, and it indicated that it's not entirely clear that residential drywall would necessarily be a quicker system or more quickly handled, and it indicated that the means manual was an industry-wide standard. There may be positions or arguments to the effect that residential may go a little more quickly than commercial, but it was something the district court looked at the facts in this case and decided it did not make an appreciable difference, and that was her factual finding, and whether it was proper or not basically is something that one would go to the clear error standard to determine in that case.
The worksheet, I should say, the weekly timesheet, is this a summary of what the employees put in during the week, or is this the employees, whatever you want to call it, honor system or something?
I believe this is the employees, basically their honor system timesheets or whatever. In this case, it was particularly Luis Sanchez's timesheets for the project involved.
So he, because it's all essentially in the same writing, so I assume somebody wrote it down for everybody.
Yeah, I'm not certain. It may be that the crew leader was the one who, you know, put it down for the entire group of employees.
Luis Sanchez, maybe?
Yes, that could well be, because there were cases in which I believe that the testimony, just to kind of update what I was speaking with Mr. Bauer about, I believe there is testimony with Judge Bauer I didn't want to.
In my earlier past, I was also
right.
Mr.
Right,
Bauer.
Right, okay.
He presented himself as Mr. Bauer.
Right, okay, I'm sorry about that. But in any event, when we look at this issue, I believe that the particular persons who testified, who indicated they filled out timesheets, were in fact crew leaders or foremen who would then fill out a timesheet for the entire crew. And actually, I believe that is what occurred here.
Mm-hmm. It's done weekly.
Yes, and it was done on a weekly basis.
Most lawyers will testify. They have to put things down hourly or they forget it. At the end of the week, no matter what you did at the beginning of the week.
And exactly, and that's really part of the problem here, because what the district court did is it inferred that particularly with the symmetry between these figures and the budget, they may not have accurately explained just exactly what hours the particular employees worked here.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about that. Was there an issue with any of these employees about whether they were legal?
That was not in the record, and I don't want to go outside the record, but it is drywall is a significantly Hispanic workforce, but you know that's basically all I can say.
And they're all union members, are they?
Well, excuse me?
They're all union members, though.
They're all represented by the union, mm-hmm. and we attempt to make sure that they're all members. So.
Well, this is pretty perplexing. It took 2 years to get this opinion.
Yes, it was no doubt a very difficult opinion for the district court to decide in light of what was involved, and she carefully considered the facts in present here, basically determined that the various time records were not sufficient in order to permit a determination with respect to the hours that were actually worked. And what she based this on, as we indicate in our brief, was number one, the past practice that was clear in this industry of paying in accordance with piecework. Number two, the testimony of the two employees who fairly clearly indicated that the hours on these timesheets didn't reflect the work they actually performed. And then finally the symmetry really between the time records and the budget in a situation where they seem to match much more often than one would expect by chance. And in this situation, basically what the district court said is since the contract requires that we determine the total amount of hours worked by employees, we have to come up with some system where we can reasonably estimate just what those hours would be, and that's why it was settled on to perform the material audit.
Well, I guess I'm sort of amazed that I know, that, frankly, the union is pretty aggressive at getting what's coming to the union and to the fund, as opposed to these guys getting paid what they work for. I really am perplexed at that, because it clearly, if somebody's working 50 to 60 hours a week, well, that's an exaggeration. Now, I don't have as, my past isn't quite as checkered as Judge Bowers, but I did work.
Not as long, that's all. It'll get checkered as you go.
Yeah, but I did work construction, and one of the big deal there was getting overtime.
Yeah.
And if you work 10 hours a day, which we happen to do that, then you really hope that it didn't rain, because by the end of the week, you're making some big money, or bigger, not big, but nevertheless, time and a half. And these guys don't seem to have concerned, or that maybe the union wasn't concerned about this.
I think probably the way to address that in terms of inference is, if in fact the individuals were being used to being paid, quote, by the piece rather than by the hour, they wouldn't really notice whether they were in a situation where they would be, where overtime might be required. And this appears to very well have been the case here. And it's a situation where the employees, there appears to be some evidence of fear of the employer, but that came through in Mr. Sanchez's testimony. But it's a situation where if you're used to being paid by the piece, you may not notice whether you're working a particular number of hours.
Is there anything in the record to support that position? Or?
The only thing we have in the record to support that position is simply the fact that when you look at the testimony of the one employee, Mr. Sanchez, apparently at one point he stated something that he, when he spoke to the union, he stated he was being paid appropriately. Then later on he stated he was not, and he indicated that he had some fear of the employer. But that's all there is in the record, because you're going really to a point of speculation when you get beyond that. And the district court attempted to stay away from that and simply look at the issue. Do these records accurately reflect the hours of contributions? If they don't, what is the appropriate method to
The appropriate method becomes speculation.
Yeah, that's right. And then turning, there was one issue that we would specifically want to reference in Section 6 of the reply brief. There was an argument made that there was no contractual basis for a material audit. I don't believe that this argument was made in the opening brief of Royal, and it's fairly well settled that you cannot raise an argument for the first time in a reply brief. But even if this particular position was not waived, it would appear that a material audit would have been an appropriate thing to do, because under the contract and under ERISA, we're required to determine the actual contributions owed and the actual numbers of hours worked, and the material audit provided a means by which we could do that here. And unless the court has any further questions, I'll rest on the brief.
No, we have a lot of questions, but I don't think we have any answers.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Berglund, you've got 5 minutes.
With regard to the accumulated liquidated damages, on page 24 of our initial brief, we did assert that there was no testimony elicited by the funds in support of that claim. With regard to the complaint filed by the plaintiffs in this case, which is included as Plaintiff's Exhibit 1, in paragraph 8 thereof, they state that monies are owed under the audit, and in their prayer for relief, they are seeking monies they claim are due under the audit. They do not allege separately as a cause of action in their complaint or in their prayer for relief that Royal is liable for accumulated liquidated damages. That claim just was never asserted by them in their complaint. And the court, it can't even construe their complaint as encompassing that type of a claim. It's a separate cause of action.
And how do we factor in Exhibit 15?
Exhibit 15 says on one page, Royal owes X amount number of dollars in liquidated damages. There's no calculations, nothing. Nothing. And that was part of the overall audit report.
Is that just where this amount of $17,955 comes in? Is that the only place that's in the record?
That's the only place. And what the trial court did was the amount on Exhibit 15 is referred to as $23,000, and the trial court reduced it to $17,000 because in a prior lawsuit, the funds executed a release of claims through November 1998.
Did you contest this post-trial to the district court?
We did not contest it. We didn't have an opportunity to contest it. The trial court ordered the parties to file an agreed-upon calculations proposal if we could do so. Otherwise, we were ordered to submit simultaneous briefs on the damages issue. We couldn't reach an agreement, therefore we simultaneously filed our own separate proposals. The trial court didn't reopen the proofs. And in the fund's proposal, they slipped in affidavits, which we didn't have an opportunity to contest. With regard to Louis Sanchez, he testified that nobody at Royal ever threatened him. He never complained to the union, never, not once. He had worked for Royal from at least 1998 to 2001 for 4 years. Royal's workforce is not transient. Its employees work for them for several years. They didn't come 1 year and leave the next.
I think that's why they said they were making money later on. Everybody knew what they were doing. I thought it was in the brief. Somewhere.
Royal's workforce, they worked in crews. And again, that's one of our arguments why this.
Experienced and skilled as time went on.
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. And in finding that Royal owes money based upon this formula, the trial court found that Royal had more apprentices than any other contractor. That was inaccurate. The trial court confused Royal International with Service Decorating. Service Decorating had approximately 67% of apprentices, whereas Royal International had 16%. You know, apprentices are much less productive than journeyman tapers. A good example for me to give the court as to why this formula is flawed is the videotape. In the videotape, it's shown Royal's employees can finish or fire tape 26 sheets of drywall at 1 hour. Under the fund's formula, it would have been over 9 hours. This formula is more of a penalty, and it's not designed to compensate them for any damage they think that occurred to them. This isn't a case where the funds went in to audit Royal's records and found the records insufficient. That didn't happen here. They went into Royal's offices. They conducted the audit from day one under this formula. They didn't inform Royal what they were doing. Royal thought that they were undergoing a regular payroll audit, which did not happen in this case. Unless the court has any more questions, I'd rest on the briefs.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.